The second annual Heritage Radio Network Holiday Auction and Gala is now less than a week away. It takes place this coming Monday, December 3rd, 2018, at the Elegant Winter Garden at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. Tickets and information are available at heritageradionetwork.org/gala. That's heritageradionetwork.org/gala. Hope to see you there.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hooney Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I think that the most important part of creating and running and maintaining a team like the one we have at Faviken is to make sure that people are happy when they're working there so that they stay. Because the only way to create that understanding is by letting time pass. And you can't, I mean, you can't write like a little, you know, little letter and give someone, this is the way you should feel. It doesn't work. And then I've also understood that not everyone will always get it. Mm-hmm. And in a team the size of the one at Faviken, with almost 50 people working together, I mean, you just have to accept that some people there, they're just cogwheels in the machinery. And they will never be able to get the full scope of what's going on. And they don't need to either. Because they might be, you know, in the wrong place in their career. They might be too inexperienced. They might, but they still serve a very important function.
That is Chef Magnus Nilsson of Faviken Restaurant in Sweden and the author of the recently published Nordic Baking Book. Our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, here with Caitlin Friedman.
Good morning, Andrew.
Caitlin, I so wanted you to be here for this intro that I've held it until the show drops today. We're recording this early in the morning on Wednesday. I'm supposed to deliver my show on Tuesday, but I asked them if they could put it together at the last minute because you and I, as the holiday season has descended, have been ships in the night.
I know. I was actually looking at the calendar, and I think tonight is like one of the only days
we're actually both home tonight.
Yeah, and we have a meeting at the school, so we're not even home.
Well, that's good. But I also won't be eating and drinking, and hopefully tomorrow I'm going to wake up feeling better than I do today.
Yeah, I'm not feeling 100% myself, but I'm happy to be here.
Oh, my God. It's already happening. Well, I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving. At some point, I'll get into it, but I had an amazing couple of days right after our last show. I had mentioned I was in Los Angeles pitching a docuseries based on my book. It was quite a successful trip. You shouldn't talk about these. I probably shouldn't have even mentioned the trip, but it was great. I actually went to a benefit the night I arrived. A dear friend of mine, actually one of the producers on the project, invited me. She was the chair of the first annual fundraising gala for the Ed Asner Family Center. And at my table, this was like plunged right into Hollywood. Art Smith, Chef Art Smith, that's not really Hollywood. Sort of is,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, it sort of is, actually.
Because of the people he cooks for.
Yeah, yeah.
But Angela Bassett was at my table. The Queen of Wakanda.
Was she tiny?
No.
Really?
No. She is an imposing figure.
Huh.
Yes.
Because, you know, most celebrities you meet, they're
yes.
tiny.
And her arms are not a special effect. She has very impressive musculature. She was very nice. She was very nice. It was great. Michael Shannon made remarks, the actor Michael Shannon, who mm-hmm. was actually kind of funny and goofy. He's so scary on screen. He was, for people who saw Shape of Water, he was the guy, the villain.
Oh, yeah. He is scary.
Yeah. He can be very scary. He was funny. Then I had those meetings. Then I went to the Miami Book Fair back in my hometown, which was my first time at the Miami Book Fair, which was an incredibly well-run event. And all of their volunteers are really well trained. No one, I always tell people to call me Andrew, but until I did that, nobody called me Andrew. It was all Mr. Friedman.
Oh, but that's, I hate that.
No, but people who are listening who are in the hospitality business will appreciate that that is good training.
Yes,
it was
absolutely.
Very consistent for an event that, you know, only exists for about a week. Probably a lot of people who return year after year, but probably also a lot of first-timer and one-timer volunteers. It was very impressive. They took really good care of the authors. And also in the little, like, author green room or hospitality area, there were all these huge people who I really had, like, Steve Kornacki from MSNBC.
Oh, you didn't tell me that.
Yep. And
did he throw out some stats for you?
I didn't get to talk to him. David Korn, from Mother Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah, all my
MSNBC.
All my favorite guests and regulars from my lefty network. And I found out afterwards that Peter Biskind, who wrote the book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and people who know that book or have seen me interviewed might know, that was like my inspiration in many ways for Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, my book. He wrote a book about the American film directors of that era. And he apparently was there on the day I was speaking, and I had no idea. I would have definitely gone and been a really annoying fanboy.
I was like, stalked him a little bit.
He's probably glad I didn't say hello. I regret it. I wish I'd known he was going to be there. And then I was on this wonderful panel. You know, I always say I'm a chef writer, not a food writer. This festival, without any prodding or guidance from me, did not put me on one of the cookbook or food writer panels. I was on a cultural panel. I was with Joe Hagan, who wrote Sticky Fingers, the unauthorized biography of Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone magazine. He was amazing. What a great writer. What a great writer. It was tough going after him. I was nervous to read some stuff. And then Miriam Powell, who wrote The Browns of California about the Brown family. The most well-known member of that family is Jerry Brown. Amazing writer and historian. And then me. It was great. They get me.
Yeah.
My hometown book festival gets me. So that was nice. Okay. Today's guest is Magnus Nilsson. I would describe Magnus as a prestige guest.
I agree.
Magnus has the restaurant Faviken in Sweden, which is much lauded. He grew it from a little 8-seat, literally one man show, where he was alone, to a, you know, much larger restaurant now with an average-sized team of, you know, cooks and servers and all that. It's a worldwide regarded restaurant. He was on Mind of a Chef. He was on Chef's Table. That's like the big double whammy. If you're on both of those shows, I would say you are a prestige chef. He was in town because he is promoting the Nordic Baking Book, which is a book that he recently came out with. He put years of research into it. It is not his own recipes. It's not like the dessert book of Faviken. It is a scholarly but fun-to-read collection of essential Nordic baking recipes. And it follows on the heels of another book he spent years on called The Nordic Cookbook. And he took the same approach there. It's in many ways a selfless act. And what fascinates me about Magnus, and you can sort of tell just from what I said, is he, not just a chef, we talk about it in the interview, but he's a bit of a scholar, he's a photographer, he's got all these pursuits that he goes after with a lot of passion. I don't personally understand how he has the bandwidth. He's really young, he's in his early 30s, and I have to tell you, and I knew this from other interviews, and I've heard other people who've interviewed him say this, he's probably one of the smartest people I've ever sat down with. I was a little intimidated. I had to get over it during the interview. I had to recover. You know what it reminded me of? I mentioned tennis a lot. When I've seen Roger Federer interviewed, you know, he speaks a handful of languages. He never stumped for an answer. He seems to always have a thought-out answer for everything.
Oh, wow.
Magnus was like that.
I actually can't even imagine being that person.
Anyone out there who might have a chance to interview Magnus Nilsson, come prepared, because he
knows what he's talking about.
He is a very, very thoughtful, reflective, intelligent chef. And I loved this interview. I think people listening are going to love it. And I have to say, his books, the new book is available, The Nordic Baking Book. It is as is the previous one, the Nordic Cookbook, out from the House of Fiden. It has to be one of chefs' favorite publishing houses. They really let chefs do these projects that probably nobody else would.
They're known for big, beautiful coffee table books, which a lot of chefs want to do.
Yeah, not even that big, but they let chefs do things that are sort of outside the box. And one of my big revelations, and this is sort of how we lead into the interview, as someone who has collaborated on a lot of books, right? A lot of books, I think, are written for the wrong reason. You know, Scott Fitzgerald had a great line. You don't write because you want to say something. You write because you have something to say. And what really hit me when I looked at Magnus's book, which I highly recommend and loved, is that he had this very clear idea for a very big book, right? But it had a reason to exist. And I feel like having been in, Caitlin, you're in publishing and you used to do a lot of PR for cookbooks before that. A lot of times you go to these meetings and you're trying to come up with something that somebody can do. Mm-hmm. What can we sell? What's a saleable idea? I want to do a book. What's a saleable idea? Well, even though I have participated in that dark magic, I have to say that is not the way to come at a book. You should come at a book with, oh my God, there's this book I have to write. It doesn't exist. People need this.
And I'm the only one to write
it. And I'm one of the few people who could write it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really why books should exist. And I think books that come into existence out of that kind of a moment are probably going to be very well received and do very well. So that's my two cents on that. Anyway, with all that, I'm going to now send it over to our interview. This was actually conducted at Fiden on Bleecker Street in New York City. I'd never been to their offices before. So it was nice to go there. Kate Greenberg, thank you for facilitating this interview and inviting me to do it. I had a great time. Magnus Nilsson, thank you. And with that, imagine me and Magnus in a conference room in the NoHo neighborhood of New York City, starting our conversation. Here you go. I have to tell you, I had revelations when I started reading this book. I was immediately drawn into it. I found the voice to be so smart, but so simple and direct. And I realized how few books have a reason to exist.
That's very nice to hear. Thank
Does that
you.
Make sense to you? I'm not asking you to be critical of anyone in particular.
No, I mean, I kind of agree to some extent. And I think that it's actually, I mean, I never thought about these things either until I put these two books out, the Nordic Baking Book and the Nordic Cookbook.
Yes.
And I understood that not all books are created this way.
Yeah.
And I think that there is actually, I mean, there are not very many publishers today who are willing to get behind a project that's as long as this and as costly as this to create the original content necessary.
Right.
And I think that's the reason why, I mean, there are plenty of great books out there, but why a lot of books that come out are, you know, to me, they kind of often feel a bit formulated and...
Especially chef books.
Yeah, especially chef's books.
Which I think these days a lot of people see them as something they need to, at least here in the United States, something you have to have, right?
Exactly.
It's a marketing tool. It's an excuse to get booked on television if you've been open for a few years. Yeah. I've just recently mentioned this in another interview on the show. You know, I've had people who represent chefs refer to a book as a product. You know,
yeah, that's strange.
It's strange.
I mean, for me, that's never been. This is the fourth book that I put out.
Yes.
And I mean, I write my books myself. I photograph them myself.
Yeah.
And to me, I wouldn't think of another way of doing it because for me, it's not a product. It's something else. It's a way of, you know, communicating something that I feel is important. Whether it's in this case, I mean, it's about food culture in the Nordics, and whether it's in the case of the first book, Faviken, it's about my restaurant and it's about my ideas. And I mean, to me, that's the only way.
So I started, you know, reading your introduction and it immediately grabbed me. You had such a clear purpose. It's both finite and I don't want to say infinite, but potentially overwhelming.
Yeah.
You talked about in there, you know, how do you define baking?
Yeah.
And then it's also very relatable because at the end of this sort of very long examination you do of, well, is it something in a pan or something in an oven?
Yeah.
You just say, I decided whatever I think is baking, you know.
whatever feels right is in there. No, and that was the thing. I mean, I mean, we never thought about that when I signed for this and when we made the plans together with Fiden, the publisher.
Yeah.
Like what baking actually is and what it means to say right. that you're going to make a baking book. And it turns out that it's not at all very easy to define baking. And that's how it ended, you know, for me, that mm-hmm. pretty much anything that I emotionally felt belonged in the book,
yes.
it's there. So yes. there's also like jam and, you know, things like that and
right.
pancakes. I mean, would you have a baking book without any pastries that are unbaked? I mean, there are many like chocolate oatmeal balls. There are many like sweets and things like that have never been inside of an oven. So that couldn't be a deciding factor, right?
You know? Right. But you also make the point, which I also loved, where you said, and this again to me speaks to how sort of unassuming it is, right? Because there's a clear, and everyone who's listening to this, you guys know, I usually, if someone's promoting a book, I get to the book in the last five minutes of the interview. I just want to talk about the person. But this is really, I think, a phenomenal book. But you clearly have gone through this thoughtful process. I don't know how far you got with it. And if I've read accurately, you at one point wanted to be a marine biologist. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's correct. I mean, it was when I was choosing which high school to go to.
Mm-hmm.
I applied for two. One for marine biologists and one cooking school. And
yes.
then, I mean, I decided in the very, very last moment that I went to cooking school.
Okay. I can see the scientist in you when I look at this, because it's very yeah. methodical, the yeah. way you go about that. But then what was so refreshing is you talk about the example of the jams, right? You say, you know, then there are these things which are recommended accompaniments or spreads, mm. and you use this word, which was so stunning to me in the context where you, do you know the word I mean?
No.
You say, would you just like that the book recommends that you go buy a jam, or would you like a kick-ass recipe for jam? You use the phrase kick-ass, yeah. right? After this very yeah. thoughtful, analytical, maybe two-page long yeah. examination of what baking is, which again, this is why I like the book so mm. much. So
thank you.
Question for you.
Yep.
I've never been to your restaurant. I've mm-hmm. never been to your country, to be honest. So mm-hmm. I'm at a disadvantage in discussing. So please correct me if I'm wrong about yep. anything, but I did go online and I looked for English translations of some of your menus.
Mm-hmm.
And this struck me, and I'd love to just see what you make of this. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how ordinary this is, or if this was just one menu that happened to have this. But the first menu I found had as the first bite or snack, I don't know what term you use, prefer, mm-hmm. but these mm-hmm. this yep, kind of yep. rush of
yep.
bites that you send out to people. It was a linseed,
yeah.
which we would call flax seed here, mm-hmm. Crisp, I think, with vinegar,
yeah.
Maybe a mussel.
Exactly.
Right?
A mussel dip, yeah.
Okay. Now, this is the first sentence in your book. A seed is a fantastic thing. This can't be a coincidence.
I think it is, but maybe you know, subconsciously it's
yeah.
not. You know? I never thought about it, actually.
You didn't?
No.
Okay. When I say this to you, mm. what's the commonality between this book, that seems to me it has to be, there you know, has to be some larger
I
truth there.
Probably, I mean, the thing is that when I started this project, which is, I mean, it's been a long project. So
yeah.
for me, these two books, they're not separate items. It's one long research process. And they were both sort of commissioned at the same time. And it's been a 6-year long sort of journey of learning from my
side.
For the
two books?
Yeah.
Okay.
So 3 years in, the Nordic Cookbook came yeah. out, and now this one. And initially, very naively, I said that obviously this is not going to affect Faviken, because, I mean, this is home cooking.
Right.
And that's not what we are about.
Yes.
But, you know, clearly, if you, as a creative person, spend 6 years doing something
yeah.
passionately, spending a lot of time doing it, naturally it will filter into the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's an example of, you know, that.
So
I
mean, that,
I didn't think about that.
Was that crisp I'm referring to? How long had that... Was that only on for a limited period of time? Is that
It's on right now. I mean, it's been there for a few years.
But it came after you had started this research.
It came from a recipe that's actually in this book
yeah.
that my wife had found on the back of a box of crackers.
Okay.
They were like these seed crackers.
Okay.
And they were so delicious. And
yeah.
I made them, and then I took away one seed at a time
yeah.
until there was only the flax left.
Okay.
And that's sort of the beginning of the flax seed cracker that we do at Faviken.
Yes.
And the original recipe is in the baking book,
mm-hmm.
like the one from the back of the cracker box.
Well, let's talk about this for a minute, though, because you do, here again, you spend, little more than two pages just talking about seeds
yeah.
as an entryway into this baking book. Why is that? What's the importance of that for you?
I mean seeds in the sense of baking is usually the seeds from any cereal crops, any perennial mm-hmm. grasses.
Yeah.
And if you go to any marginal climate, any place in the world where historically you had to produce an excess of energy in summer and store it throughout the winter months, mm-hmm. I mean, grains are incredibly important.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating, actually, that it doesn't matter if you go to like the Peruvian Andes or to a monastery in Bhutan or to right. like Sweden. There will be like a combination of these grains,
yeah.
Whether it's corn, red corn or red rice or corn or
yes.
wheat,
yeah.
And some kind of dairy product will have been like the fuel of the populations in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is one of the reasons why baking culture is so important in the Nordics still, and why it's still practiced in the home,
mm-hmm.
Because it used to be, you know, vital in the past, and right. now we do it because we like to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that very often we like things that used to be important for us, and I think that this is like a subconscious way of our, like, you know, the sort of the collective knowledge transfer between generations.
Yes.
It's like, I think that these the things that are pleasurable are often important to keep transmitting, you know, so that the knowledge isn't lost. So I think it's like the knowledge that's been transmitted, like cultural knowledge is transmitted through, like from generation to generation in a way that's not fully properly explained yet. You know, we know how it sort of happens, but
yes.
it's a lot more than like reading a book. It's about, you know, absorbing everything that's around you. It's about perceiving how life functions, like
right.
the details and so on. And I think that often things that we, you know, find very pleasurable today
yeah.
are those who were vital for survival in the past. And I think that that's like a function that's built into our way of teaching the next generation.
Right.
You know, what's important to pass on for the next generation.
But you were speaking specifically to the Nordic sensibility, mm-hmm. no? When you said, when we started down this path.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and I think that that's the reason why baking is more integrated into like the contemporary food culture in the Nordics and almost anywhere else, like home
yeah.
baking,
yes.
is that almost nowhere else has it been more historically important to know how to
okay.
process stored
grains.
Saying. It's
yeah.
a very long train of thought. But,
yeah,
but
yeah,
essentially,
yeah.
we like to yeah. do things today that we used to have to do before. And I think it's because our bodies are telling us to not let go of that information because you never know when you're going to use it again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, chances are that... And this is interesting, actually, because I don't know how it is for you, but if I bake a cake,
yes,
I find that very pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
I find it more pleasurable than if I bake an oven omelette.
Mm.
And I, you know,
right.
it's I can't explain why.
Yes.
And I think this applies to almost everyone, actually.
Interesting. I don't think I would disagree with that, although by nature, if we have a dinner party at my home, I do the savory and my wife bakes.
Yeah.
But when I do bake, I know what you're talking
it's
about.
Like there is something a sense primal. Of something, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we all feel that. I mean, nostalgia is also a prime motivating factor for transmission of knowledge between people and generations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's just, you know, humanity.
Yeah.
That is one of our great strengths, is that we not only have, you know, the knowledge that we acquire ourselves by making many mistakes in a lifetime, we also have the transmitted information from
yeah.
previous generations that was
right.
given by us and that was built upon their mistakes.
Right.
And I think that's sort of, I mean, that's not just something that, oh, we'll write this book about this and we'll hand it on to the next generation. There's
yeah.
also like many other ways for that knowledge to be passed on.
You know? Mm-hmm. This book, you spent all these years on it, right?
Yeah.
And on its predecessor.
Yes.
But you also said you very much want to capture what Nordic baking is right now.
Yeah.
Right? How quickly do you think these things change?
Quickly. More quickly than we think.
Are there things already that you see that you think, oh,
there
you
are
know, if I were working on it now, I would have...
would have been included. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing with cooking in general and baking in particular is that a lot of the things that we find very sort of, let's call them authentically traditional today, we kind of tend to think that they've been there forever, but most of the time they aren't very old, those recipes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think you can look at all sweet baking, for example. I mean, in the Nordics, as in most parts of Europe, I mean, before industrialized shipping, pretty much the only source of sweetness that would have been able to, you know, be had in a form that could be added to a recipe would have been honey.
Mm-hmm.
And then, little by little, we kind of perhaps had some imported cane sugar, which would have been very expensive still, probably mostly available for like royalty and very wealthy households. And not in a quantity where you could like bake cakes and things like that, other than on special occasions perhaps, but more often used back then to sweeten food, because that was a way of showing wealth, right?
Yeah.
You know, so they had the savory food that was pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started growing sugar beets in the Nordics and making our own sugar. And this is not more than 120 or something years ago.
Right.
And all of a sudden, sugar became available, much cheaper, much easier to come by. And we had this explosion in sweet pastries. So all of these buns and things that people feel are so authentically Nordic, I mean, they're just a couple of generations old.
You know, like I remember speaking to David Kinch about the Manresa book.
Yep.
And he said, if I started the book right now, it would be a different book when I finished it in a year. And it was a year after the book came out. I mean, that's just one person's cuisine. But I've heard an interview with you where someone said, how do you define yourself? And you just simply said chef.
Mm.
But you seem to me like somebody who wears many hats.
Yeah, I do. And the thing is that I enjoy many different things.
Mm-hmm.
And but my profession is that of a chef.
Yes.
That's what I do most of the time. And that's sort of, that's my everyday thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what's great, though, is that, you know, being successful in that has also allowed me to do a lot of other things that I think for most people would have remained hobbies, like, you know, things you did in your pastime.
Photography,
for example, or writing or, you know, gardening or whatever. But it's allowed me to integrate those passions into my profession in a way that I find very interesting, and it's very it creates a lot of change in like the everyday life, and I think that I would get very, very bored if I only did the same thing every single day. I mean, it's a great advantage. I mean, you're given a hand of cards, and if you are successful in one field, that hand of cards tends to be better stacked for the next time.
How unusual is this sort of mindset where you come from in a chef? In other words, you know, a lot of there's this sort of it's a slight stereotype, but it's not inaccurate, generally speaking. A lot of people in the United States who come to cooking, they almost aren't suited to anything else, right? And you very often find that this is, you know, it's full immersion, right? And that is really their life.
Yeah.
It's almost, and not that I haven't talked to other chefs who have, you know, other interests and whatnot, the breadth of yours and the depth of your commitment to these things seems, I don't know, you seem to have quite the bandwidth.
I think it's actually, I mean, you're right in one way, but that trait in a chef is also slightly over-exaggerated. It's something that you're supposed to be, you know?
Mm.
And I remember having dinner in a little panel once that was pulled together by a chef friend of mine. It was a whole bunch of very successful chefs around the table, and also some other, like there's some academics and researchers and so on, like 12 people. And then everyone didn't know each other, so there was like a little round of introductions, and all the chefs, they said the same thing. It's like, you know, I didn't do well in school, and I, you know, found my passion in cooking, and, you know, and we heard that many, many times, and it's always become, and when it became my time, you know, I felt that I had to say how I actually really felt about this. And I mean, I did great in school. I was very, very good at school.
It's not surprising.
I enjoyed
anyone
it
who's
as well.
Heard you interview, that's not surprising.
And I enjoyed you.
Yeah.
I enjoyed
right.
it as well. And,
right.
All of these things. And then that made me think that, I mean, that applies, that there's definitely an element of the world of cooking, accepting people that aren't accepted in other places. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I feel like people also make that up a little bit because that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, the world of cooking is full of like highly driven, very ambitious, very intelligent. Like very educated people. Mm-hmm. And not everyone is the same, but not everyone is the same in the other direction either.
Right.
You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, and even people who I think were what I call incompatible with formal schooling.
Yeah.
Just so I'm being clear, I don't mean to suggest at all that these are not intelligent people.
No, but
I just think there's different ways for intelligence to be received and different ways for intelligence to be expressed.
Definitely. And I agree. But it's like sometimes it's like you're supposed to be that. Some person who is, you know, as you say, incompatible with to kind of
right.
normal schooling, but and I don't think that's the case.
You know?
Not at all as much as people tend to say that it is.
Right.
And I mean, I see this around myself, and I mean, it's just a lot of chefs are just sort of very. They could have been something else, you know.
Yeah, of
something
course.
Else creative.
Yeah.
Or something else craft driven, a little bit
yes.
depending on which sort of direction you would, you know, want to work.
Do you consider the various things that you do, like I brought up this example of the flaxseed, right? Mm. Do they exist in sort of separate silos for you, or do you see it all sort of as a...
It's all one
all
big mess.
All feeding each other. Yeah, or all one big mess.
Yeah.
Does that question make sense? Because it seems...
It does. And for me, it's like I've never been able to separate work and not work and different fields. And it's all one to me. And it's just life. And then I happen to get paid for some of it.
Yes.
Which is essential for the rest of it to function. But it's all one. And for me, like... The cooking couldn't exist without the other things. The writing wouldn't exist without the cooking, and it's like it's all one entity of process.
Mm-hmm. Although you pursue these things, come up as they come up, right?
They do.
And then they seep into each other.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm in many ways privileged like that because I've had and still has a very successful career as a chef that, as I said before, enables me to perhaps, you know, not stack the cards differently, but make more of the opportunities that I'm dealt than someone who hadn't had the same level of success in their sort of primary occupation.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's the greatest thing with Faviken having become very successful. Yeah.
What first drew you to cook? Like when you say you were torn between marine biology and cooking, right? Those are two very different. Although you are actually the second chef I've met who started.
Really?
Well, there was a chef named David Waltuck.
Mm-hmm.
He's still around. He's a friend of mine. For 30 years, there was a restaurant called Chanterelle here in New York.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah, it was a very important restaurant. It was around from 79 to 2008, maybe. Mm-hmm. And he had initially gone to school for marine biology.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
But he never finished. But what was it that took you down the road that you ended up choosing?
For me, I mean, growing up, cooking was always considered very important. Food was important. We ate very well. Mm-hmm. Both of my parents cooked a lot. We all ate together, and I think that like a passion for cooking, because passion is the only factor that matters if you're going to go into cooking, I think. I mean, without that, people generally don't start cooking, and if they do, they generally leave pretty quickly, you know, if they're not passionate about what they do. And that type of passion, I think you can get from many directions and many sources. But for me, it came from there. It came from my family.
I mean, you have a very specific point of view
in
your cooking that I don't associate necessarily. I know home cooking figures into it, but I don't associate that with home cooking.
No, and that there is a difference there, because I mean, a place like Faviken, a restaurant like that, its job is to reflect the produce of it, you know, the area where it's located, the culture of the same area, but to do that through a contemporary filter. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's sort of my creativity that will be that filter.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never bothered with, associating me with a certain style or trying to describe what it is that we do. I mean, I never answer the question when people ask me to describe my style of cooking, for example, because I only do whatever I feel like. And it doesn't always necessarily sort of correspond with the expectations of that kind of restaurant, but it doesn't really matter because that's the only way to do it.
Yeah. Don't you think most chefs would rather not describe, if they're honest, they'd rather... I feel like that's something that marketing people force on chefs or maybe. Journalists force on chefs.
Yeah, maybe.
I think most chefs who are the way we're talking about it right now, right? Not just someone who runs a kitchen, but some, and not necessarily someone at the level that you operate at, but someone who does their own food, let's call it, right? I think most of those people would just like to say, I do, like, if it's mine, I do Andrew's food. That's what I do. I'm not part of a...
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that's probably definitely the case, you know? And the thing as well is that, like, the world of chefs is very unfair today.
How so?
In the sense that no one ever, when you go to cooking school, no one ever tells you and teaches you how you're going to communicate what it is that you do. That's not part of the deal. You're not even taught how to, you know, talk about perception or anything like that. No less talking about your brand and, you know, things like this. So those of us who find it enjoyable to have a conversation with a journalist or to talk in front of 500 people about what it is that we think is important, we are always going to be at an advantage over those who would not like these things. Mm-hmm. And those who like... communicating in that way are not necessarily any better or any more interesting as chefs. It's just that they're generally, they enjoy talking about it a bit more.
Don't you think there's also a danger in putting a name to what someone does? You know, I used to work in the film business, and I've never talked to any of these people directly, but I do feel like there were film directors who... you know, at the peak of their career almost, someone would identify what they do. Right? And then I felt like they would try to be that person.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I remember for years, you know, people talked about this director, David Cronenberg, who makes these horror films, and they said, oh, he makes body movies. And then he made some terrible movies, but they were that. They fit into that box, but they were terrible, you know? And I think you see that with musicians. I think you see it with authors. Too. I think all of a sudden you're trying to follow someone else's script or a script that you were following earlier.
No, I think you see that with chefs too. And I think that's exactly like what you said before, that most chefs who are driven by passion, they most likely wouldn't want to put the word on what it is that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But because everyone does for them, you know, it's very easy to also feel that you have to be in a certain way. And I mean, you can see there's like two layers to this as well, because one is like the mature chef who just feels that for the sake of their business and the sake of their, you know, everything that they want to do, they have to conform to a certain style or way.
Yeah.
And then there is also the other thing, which is like the immature chef who explores different styles and so on, and that's good, whilst the first thing is not good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to sort of to come around that or how to make that better. I sort of see it all the time, and I see people who are clearly not doing what they believe is the best way of doing things.
You know, it's funny. I spoke at the Culinary Institute of America not long ago, and a student said to me, it was a panel, so they asked all of us. I was the only writer. The other people were chefs and restaurateurs. And they said, what's the advice you would give a young chef? And I never really get asked that because I'm not a chef. And I said, you know what? When something grabs you, follow that.
Yeah.
Right? Because... yeah. If you look at the most successful chefs right now, they are people, it's, you know, I look here in the States at someone like David Chang.
Yeah.
Okay. When he opened that first noodle bar, was that an obvious thing? That was probably the least obvious thing for someone with his training to do, right? Mm. But he had a spark.
Yeah.
You know?
And he went for it.
And I think that's where, if you look at most of the people who have caught the public's imagination, that's true of them. They were doing something that initially was very esoteric.
Yeah. And I think it's also, I mean, one because I also very often get asked that. And I think one thing that I often think about is that, you know, it doesn't have to be this way, but it helps a lot to, like, start with the right people. To start working for...
the people you work for.
Yeah. Straight from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to work with people that care. It's the only thing that really matters. It doesn't matter very much how much a restaurant charge for its menu. It doesn't really matter, you know, whether every single product is locally sourced and organic. It doesn't really matter. Like, all of these things.
You're talking about as a young cook deciding where to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what matters is that the people that you're working for, working with, care.
Now, what do you mean by care? About that everything? That they care about you as a young cook?
No, they care about what they do.
Mm-hmm.
About that there is pride, you know, that there is like a sense of importance placed on whatever it is that you're, you know, producing in that restaurant, whether it's something similar to Faviken or whether it's, you know, a very, very simple everyday restaurant that charges $10 for whatever. Right. It doesn't really matter. The important thing is that the people care about what they do. And then another thing that I very often also say in relationship to this is that as a young cook, you should stay in the restaurant. You shouldn't move around too much. I mean, all of this sort of interning and these things, it's great. Right. But it's also worthless if you don't have a certain mastery and frame of reference when it comes to the craft first. Mm. I mean, you need to know how to cook. Because I get so many, I mean, we get hundreds of applications a week to Faviken.
Yeah.
And most of them are completely unthinkable. You read like the whole, it's like reading the world's 50 best restaurants list.
I hear this from so many people today.
And then it's like they're, you know, 20 years old.
Yeah.
And the only thing you know is that they might be very ambitious and driven people, but they're not going to be able to cook because they've spent a couple of weeks to some months on each place, which is not long enough for anyone to want to teach anyone to cook. And it's not long enough to develop like a true understanding for craft. So, and I would any day employ a chef who's worked for 3 years, as an example, in a well-run, but perhaps not particularly ambitious restaurant that cooks well.
Yeah.
Because that will show a sense of, you know, perseverance from the person. And it will also show that the employer has clearly seen, like, a value of keeping this person around for 3 years.
Right.
And that means that most likely they've invested in the person, teaching them how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And if this person has also, after that, done a handful of internships in the world's greatest restaurants, I mean, then it's a sure thing that we'll employ that person.
Right.
But if it's only 5 or 10 world-class restaurants and no foundation, I mean, they will never even get past the first sort of screening. Like a four-leaf clover, like a tiny bride, landing on all four.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enamel cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Not only because I use it constantly, but because cabinet space is at a premium in New York City kitchens. My boyfriend and I were gifted our Le Creuset by his family last Christmas, and it was the first piece of enameled cookware we'd ever owned. I'd been fawning over the marine blue color, especially when I realized there were only a few left in stock. When we unwrapped the box, we were pleasantly surprised to see how big this thing was. I immediately started imagining what I could cook. Roast chicken, Texas-style chili, a leg of lamb, or my favorite, a huge batch of Marcella Hazan's bolognese. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's lecreuset.com/HRN to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you back to the rest of my interview with Chef Magnus Nilsson in just a moment. I am alone, though. This is how tight the schedule is these days. Caitlin had to bolt after the intro to make her train into the city. My wife takes a very, early commuter train from Hastings-on-Hudson to Grand Central Station, and she's already off and running. So I'm just going to remind everybody, if you would like to follow the show, the handle on Instagram is at Chef Podcast. That's a good place to do that. You can also subscribe for free at Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever else you get your podcasts. And since it is the holiday season, I will remind you that my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, the story of the American chefs of the 1970s and 1980s, is still available everywhere. Books are sold, both brick-and-mortar stores and online retailers. I think for someone in your life who's interested in food, food history, chefs, I dare say they might enjoy it. And with that, I'm going to return you to the rest of my interview with Chef Magnus Nilsson, conducted just a few weeks ago in New York City. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. You just alluded to pride a minute ago. Mm-hmm. I've heard other interviews, read other interviews where you've talked about, there was one where somebody asked you what really bothers you as the chef. Mm-hmm. And you said when your cooks show an indifference to the diner, to the customer.
I mean, that's the worst.
Where does this come? You seem to feel this really strongly. Where does this come from for you? Is it just an innate sense of the way things should be? Is this something that you...
I think it's a matter of respect. I mean, if someone has chosen to dedicate their time and their money and their, in some ways also their reputation when it comes to restaurants like Faviken, in going to your place to eat, and you don't do whatever you can to make their experience really good, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's terrible.
Yeah.
And I think that's what hospitality is about, that you respect this transaction. That's the foundation of your business.
Mm-hmm.
And, an understanding that this business is what also allows you to be a creative individual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that also, I mean, we talk about it all the time. It's one of the things that we talk about the most with the team at Faviken, how important this is, and mm-hmm. how important that it is that every time when you do something, you have a choice, and every time you should make the choice to make it as good as you can. And the day when it happens that you don't, when you stand in front of a clear choice where the question is, if I do this, if I take option A, it'll be a little bit better for them, a little bit harder for me.
Mm-hmm.
Option B, it'll be simpler for me, but marginally less good for them. Anytime you take, the simple way out there, you're doing a wrong to, this relationship between customer and supplier of the service that we are actually mm-hmm. doing.
You think that's something you can teach people?
I think that some people have more respect for others, in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what this comes down to, respecting other people.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely think that you can explain this relationship to any person, who works in your kitchen, and really show how important it is for you, because that's mm-hmm. something that people do respond to. I mean, if people see that I'm doing this choice every day, every time, it's a higher likelihood that they will also follow suit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also that every time you see that someone is not doing this, it's something that needs to be pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we do this. We have many briefings and debriefings every day at Faviken, and there's always good opportunities to sort of bring these things up, because you can very easily see.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, you don't actually have to say something. It's enough with looking at someone. They know that they haven't done everything they could.
Yeah. You've alluded in the last few minutes a few times to things we talk about at the restaurant.
Mm.
You just mentioned the briefing and debriefing. What's the culture of your restaurant like today?
I'd like to say it's actually very nice to work there. And we've done a lot of changes. I mean, the thing with Faviken is that I came there and started that place when I was 24. And I had no real experience of managing a restaurant. I had no real experience of managing people. And I didn't know anything about how these things worked. And
mm-hmm.
there was no one there to tell me either. And I made, many mistakes throughout the years. Mistakes that have created a lot of problems for both myself and for people working there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I've learned from them. And I think that, today, when I come there, it's just amazing to see. I mean, we're So one of these things is that we've grown from one employee, which is me, to almost 50 employees.
Yeah, I actually
want
to ask you about this.
Yeah. And when I come in there today, I mean, I see like a very nice working climate. I see people who are working a decent amount of hours that are compensated for their work. I see people that stay for a very long time, which is the ultimate proof that what you're doing is fair and that it works.
Yeah.
And this wasn't the case the first years, not at all. I mean, people left very quickly because the hours were too long. I mean, I was too tough. I wasn't fair all the time. I mean, it's very hard when you're just beginning and all that you feel is that you know exactly when you do what you want to do and no one else is getting it. And they're just in the way for the vision. And I mean, at some point, either you come to a point where your restaurant ceases to exist because of this, or you come to a point where you realize how to do something about that and to build it in the other direction where everyone working there, you know, they're the wheel to realizing the vision rather than the people standing in the way for the vision becoming reality.
This is a conversation that I find fascinating. When food is as personal as your food is, you know, anybody can say to a cook, put this in a circulator at this temperature for this much time. That's anybody could do that. Yeah. A machine could do that.
Yeah.
When you have something that is as personal as what you do, that involves memories that you have, opinions that you have, as much as that can be conveyed in a food, it become the more layers of the, like this that you add on, the harder it becomes to convey to the people who are helping you execute what what it is that you're after. So my question was, how have you, because I think this is a question for any chef out there, how have you improved in communicating what's almost incommunicable
I have adopted a very realistic way of looking at this, where, I mean, I think that the most important part of creating and running and maintaining a team like the one we have at Faviken is to make sure that people are happy when they're working there so that they stay. Because the only way to create that understanding is by letting time pass. And you can't, I mean, you can't write like a little, you know, little letter and give someone, this is the way you should feel, you know, this is the way you need to proceed. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then I've also understood that not everyone will always get it. And in a team, the size of the one at Faviken, with almost 50 people working together, I mean, you just have to accept that some people there, they're just cogwheels in the machinery. And they will never be able to get the full scope of what's going on. And they don't need to either. Because they might be, you know, in the wrong place in their career. They might be too inexperienced. They might, but they still serve a very important function.
Right. So with a staff the size that you have, you can move people into positions where they can accomplish what you need done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is. And it can be extremely frustrating when you feel like everyone is not getting it on that sort of ethereal level.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to force everyone into getting it doesn't work either. So I've just sort of decided that it's better to make sure that everyone who understands what it is that we're doing stay for a long time and that we have the opportunity to also promote and provide, you know, everyone who comes there with a lot of development. Because that's also a way of integrating people into our thought process, you know, by having them there, by challenging them gradually, and by, you know, making sure that they don't get bored with what we do. And
what did you say they probably do?
No, with what we do. And it is sometimes very hard because Faviken is also a very craft-driven restaurant. It's much more so than almost any other restaurant in that segment, I think. I mean, it's not an assembly line. It relies very heavily on a handful of extremely skilled cooks. I mean, everything is cooked to order. Everything is cooked over direct heat. And there's lots of things like that that, you know, aren't immediately what you see in the most ambitious kitchens of the world today. I know, at least, you know, this might be me being extremely arrogant, but I think that I know that most of the things that we do on any given day, you know, one task I can do better than the person who's doing it every day. Yes, because I'm actually very good at cooking. But the understanding of like how the team and the restaurant functions, which means that
I could do all of those components better than everyone, but I can't do all of them. If I tried to do all of them, the end product would be so much less good than what it is now.
Sure.
So it's like, you know, it's a crossroads. You have to choose what it is that you want to do. Either you want to run a tiny, tiny little restaurant and do everything yourself the way you want to do, and it might be the greatest restaurant there is. Mm-hmm. But then it'll come with a lot of downside as well.
Yes.
You know? Or you build a strong integrated team like the one we have, where you accept that not everyone is going to understand every ethereal quality of what you do, but the product, you know, if we call it that, the mm-hmm. experience for the diner,
yeah,
it's going to be so much, you know, bigger and stronger and more complete every day.
Yeah,
because it's not reliant on one person.
You know? Mm-hmm.
But that's been a real challenge, because it is. I mean, it is about passion, and sometimes you have to let go of things that intuitively you don't want to let go of.
When you see someone not performing to the optimal level,
yeah.
I mean, you have a lot going on, mm-hmm. right? Is it hard for you to resist trying to invest more in that person than me? You said you have to accept at some point that some people are just cogs, right?
Yeah.
At least at your restaurant at yeah. this moment in time. Is it hard for you to resist the impulse to teach, the impulse to try to move those people along?
No, it's actually the other way around. I still, even though I've come to these realizations, I still have to tell myself that I have to teach people. That I have to teach them how okay, this works, so because otherwise they will never be able to do what I hope for them to do.
And you personally need to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not always. I mean, but I have to be the source of this. You
yes,
know?
Right.
Either I have to do it myself, or I have to make sure that someone else does it. Because that's the thing. I mean, the easy way out is to just not do it.
Yeah.
To just sort of do an ostrich and just sort of dunk your head in the sand. And,
sure.
And, you know, just pretend that you didn't see that they're not able to execute, mm-hmm. you know, the vision. But that's not particularly fruitful. But it is the easiest and the most human way of doing it is actually to just not do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to tell myself every day that when I see, you know, things that aren't necessarily going the way we want. I mean, the reaction that's the most fruitful is usually not just telling someone that they did wrong.
Of course,
You know, but that's not very easy in the moment, because that's the immediate gut reaction you have, is to either just not do anything, because that's the easiest way, no conflict, nothing,
mm-hmm.
Or to just tell them that you're stupid, this is not mm-hmm. done that way, you know, mm-hmm. come on, shape up.
Yeah.
But none of those things actually produce anything, any you know, better results. So. Yeah. The way we tend sort of worked with this, because there's so much passion getting in the way from rational thinking as well when it comes to cooking. So the way we've structured this is that, I mean, we have a fairly large management team, and we have rules on how feedback is dealt with. And one of them is that it's the only person who decides what feedback is delivered during service and not is the person who is expediting the pass.
Mm.
You know. And that's usually one of the two head chefs. And they're not actively participating in the cooking. They're only expediting the pass.
Mm-hmm.
And if they feel like something is happening that puts quality at risk to a degree that it needs to be dealt with straight away, they deal with it straight away.
Yeah.
If they feel that this is something that we see that's not perfect, but that's not going to put at risk the experience for the customer, right. Then they don't say anything.
If there's no urgency, it's not treated urgently.
No, then they say nothing.
Yes.
They list the pass, and they make notes. And then after service, when we have our last briefing of the day,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they will review those notes together. It will be both of the head chefs together with the sous chefs, and they will review the notes, and they'll decide which two or three things out of a very long list, usually, mm-hmm. with like maybe 50 things on, that are actually worth bringing up. Because there's no point in bringing up all of those 50 little details. And some of those details, they only seem important right there and then
mm-hmm,
in the moment.
Sure.
So you go through that once again, and you end up with a few talking points that will be like the topic of discussion for this sort of debriefing. And it's a system that works, because it does take the... If everyone who at some level is allowed to give criticism to a colleague, mm-hmm. you know, someone who is a senior... if they all know that they are not allowed to do that during service ever, that there's only one person who's allowed to do that, it does take... It's a very clear definition. You're not allowed to tell this person off.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
No matter what.
No matter what.
Yeah.
The only thing you can do is to tell the guy who's expediting the pass, and then it's his call.
Mm-hmm.
Or you just get on with what you're, you know, what you're doing.
This is not unlike a chair umpire in.
Sorry.
This is not unlike a chair umpire in a tennis match.
I don't know. But it is. I mean, it actually works because it takes that edge off, and it takes like it sort of mitigates some of those very sort of stressed sensations that you can have.
Because it takes away the option.
It does.
So someone isn't sitting there debating whether or not to say something because there's
no
debate.
It's just not an option. There's nothing can never happen.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
And if it happens, it's one of the things that we immediately make sure that that person understands that can never, ever happen again because it's not part of the way we work.
I've heard you in other interviews and you've done it once or twice today. You reference a lot. You talk a lot about the importance of craft / technique.
Yeah.
A discussion that I personally love is whether or not cooking should be considered an art.
Mm.
Okay. Most chefs I know, including you, because I've heard you interview, don't believe it should be. But I heard you in another interview, and this was striking to me. You said because if I'm paraphrasing it right, that the premium is first and foremost on technique or on craft. Is that accurate?
Yeah, for me it is.
It is.
Most important part.
So here's my question. Where, because I know how important this piece of it is to you, usually when I have this discussion and people tell me they don't think of food as an art, chefs tell me that, they say because the first priority is it has to taste good.
No, I don't think that that's actually at all relevant, to be honest. And I think people can have their opinions, but I think that's an ill-thought-through answer. And I think that the first reason why cooking is not art is because it's bound by rules, and art is not. Art is free. I mean, you can take the comparison that every painter is not an artist. There are also people that paint houses.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, an artist is only bound by their ideas and thoughts, but a chef isn't, because you're also bound by certain rules on what sort of makes up a meal and what constitutes a dish, and we're also very much bound to the craft.
Mm.
I mean, even in the most modern restaurants, contemporary restaurants of today, you're bound to quite a large extent to some kind of executional craft.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I don't think that food should ever be considered.
Interesting. Can you say a little more about this? Because this is such a singular. This is such a singular answer that I kind of love it.
I think it's. I mean, it's cooking is a creative craft.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that you can exercise a lot of your creative vision through it,
mm-hmm.
but art is something completely different, you know?
Yeah. And I assume one of the limit, when you say it's limited or that there are certain rules, one of the constraints is you have to work with things that are edible, correct?
Yeah, for example.
In terms of a medium.
You can't serve someone a plate and say, eat the plate, you know?
Right, whereas somebody might be able to frame something that has different materials and
actually for me it is really simple. The artist is not bound by anything but their own thought process.
In theory.
You're
right.
Whilst the chef in theory is always bound by a lot of different factors.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that this whole thing, you know, with like art and creativity and all these, I mean, it's like it's so easy if you don't want to actually invest your own time in understanding something, to just dismiss it, with a word like that. It's like, I don't understand how this guy who made this painting can actually do that. It's beyond my grasp.
Yes.
So I just say that, oh, he's such a creative person.
Right.
But maybe he's just a really good craftsman. He's a really good painter.
Mm.
Maybe he's not creative at all. Maybe he hasn't actually invented a single thing that's new to humanity.
Right. Or at least in his mind. Yeah.
Or also objectively speaking.
Right. Right.
Because you and I don't understand how he does it doesn't mean that he's creating anything that's actually new.
Yeah.
And I think this is sort of just people being a bit lazy with this. You know, it's like it's easy to describe food as art because you have a high level of admiration of the creative output of someone, you know, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it doesn't have to be art because of that.
Yeah. Well, to me, this also, I didn't mean this when I brought it up, but it occurs to me as we're kicking this around that it does, to me, go back to what you said earlier about not wanting to put a name to what you do, right? I mean, art is it's a word. I mean, it's a word.
Maybe.
You know, I mean, is it even worth having that debate? at some level. Exactly. I mean, I brought it up so I can say that, right? But is that even a debate worth having? It's a little, it's a three-letter word that has a lot of meanings to whoever you're speaking to.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it is what I said. I think that it is essentially just sort of people who are not, who don't want to spend the time understanding something. It's just so easy to put one of those labels on it, and then you're done with it, and you can move on to the next topic of discussion. And I mean, art is one part, but creativity is even more is commonly treated this way. It's a word that people throw around very lightly.
Yes.
I mean, something creative, like a creative creation. I mean, it's a combination of. Like the very definition of it is a combination of previously known factors that are presented in a new way.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the case with a lot of people that are considered. I mean, myself, for example, I mean, I'm considered a very creative person. Mm-hmm. Personally, if I look at myself, I think that I'm moderately creative, but I'm very good at actually executing my creative ideas. At least I've been in the past. Mm-hmm. I have a good track record of, you know, coming up with a few things, but actually realizing a large part of them, which is not the case with most creative people, I think. Most, like the most creative people I know, they're terrible at actually getting any of it done. How to create circumstances so that those ideas can turn into something more than ideas. And I mean, I know a lot of people that are way more creative than I am.
Right, but it hasn't come to... something.
But no one knows it because they haven't been able to do anything with it.
When you, I spoke a minute ago about when the restaurant started and it was just you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 8 seats, is that correct?
Yeah, it was 8 seats from the very beginning.
In the first iteration.
Yeah.
Putting aside that you had some growing to do, do you look back on that time fondly or was that just... because if I'm not mistaken, if I'm understanding it, you were involved, you were actually at one point looking for a chef for that project.
Absolutely, and I couldn't find one.
And you couldn't find one, and then you became ironically, this reluctant.
No, I mean, I look back on it fondly today, but I also know that that's because of nostalgia, because it sucked. It was terrible. To be all alone, to be working the way I did, to not have anyone to share my ideas with, to have no one to fill in when you have a bad day. I mean, all of these things, it's just not conducive of a great life.
What kept you going through that time period?
I don't know. I mean,
did you have a vision of where you were going? Or
I did, not exactly the way it is now. I never envisioned it to have 50 employees, but I mean, I knew what kind of restaurant I wanted it to become, and that was very clear. And I think it was just pure stubbornness, you know.
You believed that if you gave yourself enough time,
I got like little encouragements. You know, along the way, when I could see that people started coming more and people came back, you know, the odd article here and there, things like that, that, you know, kept me feeling like this is actually like a development that's positive. It's like on a...
the trend line was moving in the right direction.
It was. Yeah. It wasn't, you know...
it wasn't all... terrible.
It wasn't all terrible. The difficult part was to be alone. And that's something that I can still... I mean, even in this large group, I can still feel very alone.
You mean in the kitchen?
Yeah, in the whole company. Because no one has been there as long as I have. And I mean, I have staff who worked there for, you know, 7-8 years, and they're still working there. But, you know, this thing with... I think that if I ever do another restaurant, I think that I would probably do it with a partner from the beginning. And I can often see that with... I mean, everyone works differently. Everyone doesn't want a partner. Everyone doesn't benefit from it. But I can see myself having, you know, working in a duo.
In the kitchen or the other person would be sort of...
I don't care about that. I don't separate kitchen from that. It's like it's a restaurant. We work...
So however it worked, just somebody for you to share it with from the beginning.
Have someone who's an equal from the beginning. Because even if I have people... I mean, Jesper, who's the head chef at Faviken, we worked together. I mean, we've known each other since I was... 17. I interned in a restaurant where he was the sous chef. So I've known him more than half of my life.
Yeah.
And we worked together many, many, many years. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't there from the beginning at Faviken. He came in 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So by the time that he came in, for example, even if we know each other so well, I mean, we were already past the point where he would become, you know, like a partner in the whole, in some strange way. I mean, both him and Karin and Hatim, who are the other sort of managers of the restaurant, they're a huge part of what we do.
Yeah.
But they can never be an equal part in it to me.
Yeah, it's like and it's like a step parent, almost.
Yeah,
like
it is. You can love them and you can get along.
Exactly, and, but and you weren't like, there from fruitful, you weren't you weren't same. In the delivery room.
You weren't, you know. and I think that's something that I would definitely do differently if I ever came in a position in the future where I were going to be opening a new restaurant.
That's a great thing to know about yourself, don't you think?
I think so. Yeah, I hope that is right.
Before we go, this book.
Yeah.
You said it was you had this sort of couple in mind, these two books originally. Do you have another one? You don't even have to tell me what it is, but has something else grabbed you, or has
will be more books,
sure,
mostly because I know that I really like writing. But I don't have anyone, you know, anything now that I'm working on as such. There's just plenty of ideas that have been discussed and so on, but nothing. I mean, I think that's going to be like in a year or so, I'll be ready to get on like a new project.
Yeah.
Because this is, after all, I mean, in 6 years, it's a significant amount of time.
It's amazing.
And it's just, it hasn't even ended yet. I mean, the research has ended and the writing has ended, but now is the first couple of weeks where people are actually interacting with the book, which is sort of the next step. You know?
Can you feel the difference out there? Like when the book is released into the world, does it feel different to you?
Yeah, it does.
How so?
I mean, I don't know. It's just different, you know.
You can feel that it's out there.
You can feel that it's out there, and I mean, I think it's like you know that people are talking about it, and you know. And today, it's also become so obvious that people are using the book because you see it in social media all the time.
Sure.
And that's not been the case in the past. I don't know if this is like a general development in how social media is used, or if it's because this is a baking book. But yeah, I see very rarely people posting recipes from the Nordic Cookbook. Savory recipes.
Interesting.
Whilst here, you know, it can be 10, 15, 20 a day that go in and they tag me or Fiden. And they, you know, they've made buns or biscuits or something from the book, and they're like, you know, referencing what they did.
Right.
So it becomes very tangible like that. All of these traditional and contemporary recipes are being used, and what happens then is that not only are they allowed to become part of also tomorrow's food culture, but it means that people will also absorb this information that surrounds the method and the rest, like, or the ingredients list, like all of the narrative, so they probably learn more about Nordic culture by, you know, using this book than they've ever known before.
By actually doing it.
By actually
and then
baking
and then eating it.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for your time on this trip to the city.
Thank you.
Thank you for this book. Again, the book is The Nordic Baking Book. It's a cookbook that I loved. I love spending time with it, and I learned a lot. I think it'll hit you on many levels. Magnus, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Again, a big thank you to Magnus Nilsson, not just for the interview, chef, but for this book, The Nordic Baking Book. I don't even bake, and I love this book. I've spent a lot of time with it since the interview. I obviously spent some time with it prior to the interview. I'm obviously very impressed by it. I highly recommend it. Vitor, our engineer at Heritage Radio Network, thank you for splicing these things together, as you always do. Matt, Kat, and Katie at Heritage, thank you for helping these extra shows happen over the fall season. I really appreciate it. Caitlin, I hope you're having a good commute into the city. Thanks for doing the intro with me. And to all of you out there in podcast land, all the best for the holiday season. And I will look forward to seeing you back here in a few days on Andrew Talks to Chefs.